everyone. I'm Ray Belli, and this is Words for Granted, a podcast that looks at how language changes over time. If you value this podcast as a free educational resource, you can support the show and get access to past bonus episodes by making a monthly donation at patreon.com/wordsforgranted. Thanks to Ryan, Sarah, and Daniel for their recent contributions. That said, if Patreon's not your thing, but you still want to support the show, you can make a one-time donation at paypal.me/wordsforgranted. All right, let's jump right in. Welcome to this interview episode of Words for Granted. I'm speaking with Valerie Friedland. Valerie, thanks for coming on to the show.
Sure, I'm so excited to be here.
Yeah, so you've just written the book, Like Literally Dude, Arguing for the Good in Bad English. This is a pop sociolinguistics book, and I think an important piece for us to start here is just for everyone to understand exactly what sociolinguistics is and what a sociolinguist does as their job. So let's start with that.
Sure, because it's not quite like fireman or lawyer. You know, people don't tend to instantly recognize what it is you do. So I am a theoretical linguist, which means that I study the cognitive and articulatory principles that drive language. But I do that from the perspective of how it is perceived by speakers, how it's used by speakers, how it is changing over time, which brings in the social part. So if you think about sort of sociology and social psychology and even anthropology, those angles that are very human-based and very about sort of development in society and culture, and then the piece of the puzzle that I look at from the perspective of society and culture is how language enters that picture. So who we are in terms of our age, our race, our identity and other facets, our region, how that actually affects the way we talk and the way we perceive and how that enacts change over time in language. So all these little underlying pressures we have as speakers of human language are not just blindly moving forward, or we'd all speak the same way. It actually gets picked up in different ways by different speakers for different social purpose. And that's what I study.
Yeah. And I think what's an interesting part of that, at least in the context of this show, like this show historically has been a historical linguistics podcast looking at, you know, change in language over time, mostly semantic change. But I think the subtext there is that historical linguistics is almost always sociolinguistics too.
Right, it is. That's actually been really, really fascinating in writing this book, is sort of seeing how those pieces come together. You know, primarily in my research, my actual academic scholarly research, the stuff that I would not suggest those books people pick up for easy bedtime reading, I look at things that are happening right now. You know, what are the sound changes happening in our speech today? But if you do any kind of research like that on anything that we do in speech today, it always relates to things that have happened in our history. And it's usually for the same reasons. It's not the exact same social reasons, obviously, because we change over time, but the same sorts of social pressures that interact with linguistic pressures over time have come up over and over through the centuries. And a lot of this has to do with things like migration, invasion, and even seismic cultural shifts in terms of what we deem as socially normal and acceptable. So all of these things are different in how they're realized in any particular time or space, but they're the same types of things that have happened through history. And almost always when you look at something new in language, it's tied to some of those aspects. And that's true whether it was 1,000 years ago when the Normans came over and invaded, or if it's true today when we have seismic cultural shifts in what's acceptable and what's not.
Sure. I mean, again, I'm sort of repeating myself here, but just to really tie this up is that we don't think necessarily of the Norman invasion as a sociolinguistic event, but it is. And just to clarify for listeners who might not know what the Norman invasion is, that is when, basically, without getting into details, invaders from France came into England and won, and thus French wound up having a significant impact on the English language.
Right. And, you know, first of all, the word stock alone, just thinking about words, you're talking about semantic change over time. Massive massive, massive. I can't even say the word enough times to suggest how massive the vocabulary change was, where we went from a mainly Germanic, 100% Germanic language with 100% Germanic vocabulary. I mean, you know, it might have been a few stray other things in there, but generally 100% to one that was, you know, now I think 20-25% estimate of Germanic. And French was one of the huge impacts that did that. And a lot of our Latin roots come via French. And many of our most common words come from French. So, you know, things like very, that's a French word that was from Verrey in the Middle English period. And almost all words that we have that have two versions of, so, you know, a house versus a mansion, for example, the more upper crust version, like the mansion part, is from French. And the reason we have two words is there was the existing English word, and then we got a French word overlaid. And since they were the rulers and sort of the royal court, what they did was more highfalutin. And therefore, we got different sets of words. And the big one, the ones that we want to aspire to, we all want to live in a mansion, right? Not a house. Those are usually French in nature.
Yeah, I love that perspective. So before we dive into the meat of what the new book is about, the subtitle is Arguing for the Good in Bad English. Why defend bad English? Because certainly there's a camp out there, some of whom may be literally listening to this episode, that say, well, we should be eradicating bad English. Why are we defending it here?
Well, and that's funny because I hear from that camp quite often. And that was one of the reasons I wrote the book. You know, a lot of times I'll give linguistic talks where I'm really just doing something theoretical and talking about, you know, vowel changes over time or something like that. And every single time I give a public talk of that nature, someone comes up to me afterwards and says something like, gosh, I really wish you could talk to people about why people say literally, non-literally, drives me crazy. Or, you know, gosh, how can we help people eradicate like from their language? So what I was finding is I was giving this talk on language and on how language changes over time from a very theoretical level. But then people would ask me about how language had changed over time, these new things we were using that they see as bad English, and the tools that I use to look at English changes in other regards, like vowel changes and things that we don't notice and care about in general speech. I wasn't giving them those tools to look at like or literally use non-literally or vocal fry or things we think of as bad English that way. And most of those features, and that doesn't mean we don't ever make errors in speech, but generally these are not errors, they're not mistakes, and they come to English the same way as most of the things that we think as good English have traveled into English. And it's a sort of historical misunderstanding that has been brought to us from this really strong focus on prescriptive views of language since the 18th century that have misled us about what good English and what bad English are, how we got them, and whether some of the features we think of as good today were actually bad 100 years ago, and many, many, many of them were. So if we want to say that bad English should never be considered good or never be rethought about in different ways with new views, then we should probably stop saying a lot of the things we say today. So for example, we should get rid of will and bring back shall. We should get rid of have to and bring back must. We should get rid of do and news and say you and news. And we certainly should bring back our H's in words like white and whip. But all of those were once considered bad English and now they're good English. So go figure.
Yeah. So I want to pause there. Talk a little bit about that prescriptivism, just, you know, a little bit about who it was coming from and sort of the context in which it emerged.
Sure. And that's a really, I think, getting back to your idea of how, you know, historical linguistics really can help us view language change and sort of semantic change, but also other changes over time differently. This is a good example. So I think we have to go back to this idea of the Norman invasion and what happened to English at that time. So, you know, 1066, William the Conqueror comes over and brings with him not just a new political party, a new royal house, but also a new language. And it's Anglo-French. So it's a little different than sort of continental French, but it's also vastly different than Anglo-Saxon. And it brought in, you know, new features, new sounds actually get introduced. Older forms of endings go away. You know, we lose our endings on nouns and we lose sort of verb classes over time. We are moving to this new structure influenced strongly by French, which was considered the highly esteemed language at the time. And even during this time, not only was French the most esteemed language and considered the language of what you used for religion and legal work and things like that, it was actually Latin most of the time in those contexts. So these classical languages, which were highly esteemed, that had long histories in terms of literary history, legal history, religious history, English had none of it. English was, in fact, a colloquial or vernacular language. It wasn't really written much. I mean, it was written in dialectal forms. We don't have a huge body of literature from this era. We really didn't have a printing press. Literacy was not widespread. Most of the people that were English speakers were kind of lower class because they weren't obviously speaking French. So all of this is in the mindset of the speakers of English, that this is just their language of everyday solidarity, of family, of friends, of close-knitness, of clan, right? All of those things that we think of as informal language, I mean, that was what English was. But now, skip ahead to about 1500, 1600, and we go from here, the Middle English period, to the early modern period. And this is, of course, the time of Shakespeare and Queen Elizabeth I. And what we find at this period is all of a sudden a rebirth of classical languages, but also a rebirth of English as being potentially a new classical language, a new language of education, a new language of literature, a new language to learn, to talk, to speak, to be in the court. Because, of course, English had risen to the court again. And so documents were being written in English, but really importantly, there was a printing press and books were being printed in English. So here we have, you know, these different tendencies now. You have English having had a colloquial past and still being used very much that way and lacking the vocabulary of a more learned language because we didn't talk about science, we didn't talk about religion, we didn't talk about politics in English. So it needed those words, but also it was now the language of things like Shakespeare. It was the language of the court. All of a sudden it had risen to these higher areas. And this is still 1500 to 1700 about. So what's happening at this point is we're trying to get new words into the language. This is where we borrowed a lot of words from Latin and Greek to sort of build up the vocabulary of English. This is also where we started making up a lot of words. And of course, Shakespeare is king of this because we needed new words. And so why not just take words we already had and kind of change them up a little bit and stick new stuff on them and make new compounds and use them in different ways. So one great example is how Shakespeare used a lot of nouns as verbs. So, you know, grace me no grace, uncle me no uncle, which is very similar to adulting today, right? You went from being an adult, now you're adulting. It's the exact same process over time. So all this stuff is going on. We're building up English. All of a sudden, English rises up to be a learned language alongside French and alongside Latin and alongside Greek. It's gotten the vocabulary and it has the domains now to be this better language. So then you get a lot of writers in the 1700s. So, you know, the 18th century is really the pivotal part of standardization. Writers like Jonathan Swift and Daniel Defoe, who start to say, we need to codify English because now we have this beautiful language we've developed and it's just going to go to pot because speakers are just great at bastardizing English, right? So now we will go the opposite direction of it being the language of the people that's living and moving and changing and people embrace it to being the language of literature and the language of law and the language of education where people want to stabilize it and they want to be able to transmit it over time and space. And how do you do that? How do you rise up to make this language the language of things that will be left for the future generations and things you can transmit across time and space? You standardize it, you codify it, you start writing rules about it. So again, no one had written grammars of English, not even thinking here yet of grammar usage rules, but no one had said, here are the English language rules, the same way that they had said, here are the Latin rules, right? Here's Latin, let's study Latin, let's break down its grammar. We hadn't done that with English. And so it's really not till about the 1600s, 1700s that we start to see the very first grammars of English written, and particularly with Robert Loth, who was a bishop who wrote a book for his son, who was about to go to school and learn Latin, of trying to show him, here's English, and let me relate English as a grammar to that of what you're about to learn, Latin as a grammar. And so by doing this, what he did is he analyzed English grammatically by the rules of Latin, which of course is insane if you think about it, right? So we're going to say, okay, well, I really like Russian. So let's try to reanalyze English according to Russian. That would make no sense today, but think about it if you had no rules or grammar in your language and the only rules or grammar you had ever learned were for a different language, you're going to try to apply those rules as far as you can to the rules of the language that you're trying to write a grammar for. And that's exactly what Bishop Loth did. He's become sort of known as the most famous prescriptivist on the planet because all those rules about things like not ending a sentence with preposition and, you know, not dangling your modifiers, all of those essentially started with him because those were rules of Latin that then he superimposed on English. So that was really the first grammar, and it became the grammar that got passed down to almost every school child for 300 years. It was picked up and widely copied, verbatim even, with not credit given to him by, for example, Lindley Murray, who then published the most widely used grammar used in school in the 18 and 1900s. And this then just sort of spread those rules as if they were law, when in fact, actually, they were just sort of ideas about how we might possibly start to look at English as a language with a grammar rather than any kind of ironclad, these are the principles by which we must all follow or else we're going to, you know, have a lightning bolt come strike us. And at this time, of course, the upper crust in London was thinking, well, you know, if we can get people to talk like us, then we are sort of going to be able to sell these usage guides in this new time with the Industrial Revolution and a lot of migration and mobility to people that want to be like us. So, you know, if they're going to try to be like us anyway, that way we don't have to listen to them talk. They can talk like us and we can make a buck at the same time by selling the usage guide. That is the birthplace of prescriptivism. I'm sorry, that was a very long answer to a short question, but it's a really long, fun history of why we think the rules we talk about in school today are right.
No, I love it. I was going to say, thank you for that extremely thorough answer. Yeah, and to that point, what I think is crazy is that Robert Louth's grammar has come down to us and it impacts how we speak today or how we learn the English language today. It's not like some historical relic. You know, thinking back to when I was in elementary school, and I can't really speak to what's taught in elementary schools today, but like I said, when I was in school, certainly, you know, all of those prescriptivist rules like double negatives and dangling prepositions or whatever, those were still being taught. And, you know, they have less of a basis in the English language itself and more in the basis of an ideology, a historical ideology of how the English language, quote unquote, should be. You know, I once described this retrofitting of English grammar into Latin grammar, which, you know, is not only an unrelated language, but a dead language. I call this the original sin of English grammar.
It's so funny when you think about it. People don't realize it, but it's the most bizarre thing to think to do. I mean, I can understand why he did it that way because there were really no other models for him to follow. But still, if people understood that the reason they have learned all these rules that are drilled into their head, like two negatives make a positive and don't end a sentence with a preposition, are just because of some arbitrary dude saying, huh, let's see, I like this rule, I'll stick it on English, I think they would think very differently about it. The funny thing about that rule, about not ending your sentence with a preposition, is actually if you read his original statement about it, he just says he thinks it's more elegant when you do it that way. He actually doesn't say it's wrong. He just says, oh, I think it's more elegant if you do it that way. But yet it somehow got converted and you know, sort of subverted over the years to, okay, don't ever end a sentence with a preposition, when that actually wasn't even what he originally said.
So something that comes up in the book several times, which I think will be fascinating for a lot of listeners and hopefully readers who go out and buy the book, is that women often lead the charge of language change. And so there's like so much to talk about here. So maybe I'll just open up the floor to you to say what you would like to about that.
Well, you know, I think that's one of the most surprising things about the book for a lot of people. But then if you actually step back to think about it, who are the people that we think of when we think of all the speech features that we love to hate today? So let's talk about like use, for example. Let's talk about using literally, non-literally, or so as a sentence starter, or vocal fry. When I say those, who pops into your head? You know, not an 80-year-old white guy, but a 20-year-old young woman. So we actually know. We know from our experience today with new novel language features entering our language today that it's women that lead the charge. So why it's that surprising that throughout history that's been our role, I don't know exactly, but it does seem to be surprising. And when we actually look at the data, and I'm not just talking about contemporary data, I'm talking all the way back to the early modern period. When we look at data, we find women leading the charge in many of the new features that we take as just normal and standard today. So great examples would be using you for subjects rather than ye, because actually if you look at the original pronoun paradigm, it has changed quite a bit over the centuries. And one of the biggest changes is that we've taken a formerly object pronoun, meaning a pronoun that you'd use when you are putting it after a verb. So I like you, for example, you is used there as an object, and making it a subject pronoun, which was actually not how it was originally intended. So ye was for subjects and you was for objects in the 13th century. But around 1500, you started to replace ye as a subject pronoun. And it's obviously what we do today, and no one notices that we're doing this. And so when I get mad at someone for saying him and I, I'm getting mad at them for doing the exact same thing I do every time I use you as a subject. But if we look at letters from this era, from the early modern period between 1500 and 1700, guess who does this the most? Women. It's women that lead the charge in that. Another example of something we do that's totally normal today that women historically led the charge in is using the S, third person marker on verbs, like, you know, does or makes, from doth or maketh, because that was a change coming in the early modern period. And again, when we look at letters and diaries, we find that it's women that do it more than men. A lot of this probably had to do with the experience of women at that time as being sort of socially respectable and fashionable and stylish, but not in public domains like literary domains or political domains or educational domains where standard language use was strongly pressured. So men tended to have more standard language use at that time. Women tended to use more novel, innovative, non-standard or colloquial variants. It wasn't non-standard at the time, but more vernacular, intimate, informal variants. And so they led the charge in those replacing the staid, boring, conservative ones that were used at the time, probably because they have children. And when you're the primary input on your child's first acquisition, they're going to get your system. So not only do women seem to innovate and be first on picking up on new features and coming into language, they also then pass those down to their children, which is how change progresses over time. So you have a girl and a boy. That boy might not be as innovative in his language use over his lifetime, but if you give him a more innovative system at birth, you know, from 0 to 5, that will be the system that he starts with. So it brings that change in further. And then when we look at contemporary data, we find the exact same pattern. If you look at changes coming into our speech today, it's women, women, women.
Yeah, that is very fascinating, particularly the piece about the transmission to children. So I guess just to sort of recap that and make sure that we have it right for listeners. So the linguistic conservatism that historically and perhaps even to some degree today is still prevalent in men or educated men, men who are, you know, contributing to the written record, is a social pressure in and of itself to, you know, adhere to this artificial code, essentially. And then women who are speaking outside of this restrictive code, you might say, have a more natural approach to language. Because, I mean, the reality is, you know, as any longtime listener of the show will know, language changes. That's what it does. That is one of its features, whether we like it or not. But, you know, when you impose restrictions upon it, then, you know, that change is slowed down. So I guess what I'm hearing from you is that the lack of social pressures on the way women were speaking historically and to some degree today is what actually allows for language to do what it wants to do, which is evolve, adapt, and change, and, you know, be a little wiggly.
Right, right. And, you know, I think it's not only that the social pressures were a little bit different on men and women. It's the think of the context and the topics that women talked about when they were not in those domains. So they weren't doing, you know, the business talk, but they were doing the talk of domestic life, the talk of parenting, the talk of solidarity and friendship, the more intimateness and sort of nature of what they talked about probably also contributed to the types of forums that got pushed up. You know, I think the way to think of it is women are social disruptors in language, and that's why we react to them badly a lot of times, even in modern times. They're social disruptors because the social world that they are trying to get into is usually dominated by people that have a different kind of speech pattern, usually men, and still today in most of those domains of professional life, it is male speech that's held up as the norm. And therefore, when women bring something new in and it has a different purpose and a different power, it is in many ways social disruption. Now, they're nice social disruptors, meaning they're not coming in with, you know, weapons and banging on things, but because of their position as being intimate to the people that they're disrupting. So, you know, we grow up in households with brothers and sisters. We get married with husbands and wives. So we live with the enemy, so to speak. And I mean that jokingly, of course. We live with those that use a different kind of language. The crossover between our forms of language is much greater than language innovation in other sort of more marginalized groups that don't have that intimate diversification, which is a fancy way of saying, you know, living with the person that is different than you.
Can we kind of put our finger on something specific that, you know, has caused these linguistic changes in women? Or is it, you know, do we sort of have to surrender to language changes and in the absence of restriction, language will do what it wants to do? Can we say anything more specific than that sort of blanket statement?
Well, I think, you know, we, of course, this is the big questions, the burning question of sociolinguistics. How does language change start? What drives it? What makes the same right. pressure in all people and all speakers come to the fore in some speakers and actually emerge as a change going forward when that same pressure is resisted in another population? And of course, this is why British English and American English are so different, because they started the same, but they had different social pressures on them and different levels of language contact with other languages. And those things push their languages in different ways. And, you know, what's the reason why, for example, R went away in British English, but stuck around in American English? Both of them are subject to the same pressure on R's to weaken over time called lenition, which is a natural process to sort of decrease the articulatory complexity of sounds that are articulatory complex to say, and R is one of those. And R shares a lot of characteristics with vowels, for example, and so, you know, they tend to go away and become vowels. So why did that happen in British English but not American English? And one thing interesting with that is that women seem to lead the charge in British English. So we find R-lessness dropping first in their speech. Now, when we look at their letters, we know this because they say words like worst or first as fust and west in those letters. So they seem to delete those R's, and we find it much more prevalent in their speech. So I think we have to look at this from two ways in terms of what might have inspired that in that specific circumstance or in others. In addition to just being more sort of available and accessible to natural linguistic pressures to progress, like just general lenition or weakening of sounds, we also have to say it's not just women that are changing, it's men that are changing towards a standard. And so it's this combination of factors. So men at that time read more. They were more likely to be literate. They were more likely to see documents with R's in the format, right? In the words themselves. So if you see the word worst written, you see there's an R in it. If you've never seen it written and you hear it as West, then all you're going to think is it doesn't have an R. You just don't know it has an R because that's what you've heard in your environment, whereas it's reinforced for men. So I think the trick here is it's not really just women. It's the behavior of men as well. So men had different pressures that reinforced the standard. A lot of it was the written standard, right? So what they saw in books. Women didn't have that. So they might have picked up on changes that were maybe undercurrents in speech of migrants. So a lot of times, you know, at the time of the 1500s and 1600s, a lot of people were coming to London. There was a vast migration for economic opportunity. A lot of northern dialects, northern varieties, a lot of them had a lot of Old Norse influence, for example, or Irish. A lot of Scots came in. So if women were interacting in the markets or with their children or with their, you know, their servants that had those accents, then they didn't have literacy to back it up. Those were sort of the ways of everyday speech. And the power of everyday speech is remarkable. And, you know, maybe we know we're high class and we're supposed to speak a certain way. But how many of us have never seen someone who may be sort of not who we want to aspire to be per se in terms of their socioeconomic, you know, status or other aspects of their personality or social situation, but they're still cool. There's still something about the way they talk that's attractive to us. There's emotional resonance in it, or they embody some quality like coolness or aloofness or urbanness or sort of toughness or, you know, whatever it is. And we pick up on that really subtly and we do something like maybe they dress a certain way and we pick up some aspect of the way they dress. Or in the case of language, maybe they pronounce a vowel a certain way or maybe they delete an R in certain circumstances. And we don't consciously, agentively do that, but we pick it up because it's sort of, oh, that's kind of cool and trendy and fashionable and I want that. I like that. I recognize that quality. Women seem to be available and accessible to that more because they're not as tied to the prescriptive and standard conventions that they have reiterated in their speech and are rewarded for more. So women get more rewarded for sort of social capital than men. Men get rewarded for physical strength, for economic strength, for political power. Those are not really available to women in the same degree even today. But what do women get rewarded for? Being style leaders, being fashion icons, being sort of social leaders. And so it's going to entice us to do a different set of things than men. So I think there's two sides of the puzzle. There's the male side of why they don't do it and the female side of why they do. Does that sort of clarify? I mean, it's hard
And I think it kind of, it does sort of indirectly answer like my initial question, which is, I think what you're getting at is like, you can't make a blanket statement for particular changes. Like in some way, that's the entire premise of the more narrative episodes of this podcast, which is every word has its own story. You could say the same thing about every linguistic change, be it morphological, syntactical, whatever, has its own sort of causes that are unique to that particular change.
Exactly. And it may be different for different people too, even the same change. So it's really hard to say, if you don't use a specific example, it's just hard to say blanketly why changes happen over time in some groups and not others.
So I guess this makes me wonder, what is a necessary ingredient for a linguistic change to actually have longevity, as opposed to being just like a very short-lived trend or fad? And I suppose longevity is relative, right? Because if you look at English from 1,000 years ago, very, very little old English still exists today. So I guess when I say longevity, I mean, you know, something going beyond a relative fad or trend in the language.
It's not just sort of a word like twerk or riz that probably will never be used again in a decade from now.
Right. I was thinking, I was thinking of fat from the 90s, PHAT,
because
I was actually just looking up the etymology of phishing, as in an internet scam. Phishing is spelled PHISHING. And of course, fat from the 90s is PHAT.
Right.
So that came up as a related article. And of course, I haven't heard anyone say that since like 1999.
Just brings up something. I love that word, fat. I remember that word. I shouldn't admit that. I was three. But, you know, what's interesting is both of those have that PH, and it's so funny, you know, to see that that's how it was spelled. And that's spelled that way to make it more noticeable and right, natural. Sort of the way we add Z on things sometimes to make them more noticeable and slangy and things. It's funny. That's actually a really funny way that those words were spelled, just to draw notice to them as sort of being outside the norm.
Yeah, definitely. But I want to go back to my initial question here. What is the determining factor in longevity when it comes to linguistic change?
Well, if I had the answer to that question, I would be paid a lot for my predictive abilities. And unfortunately, I'm not that great at predicting what will change. But there do seem to be some qualities that help sort of suss out what will be potentially a longer term feature of our speech versus those that are going to die out really quickly. One is that they're not just vocabulary words. So if they're useful to us in some way, and they're sort of new in the sense that they're naming something we didn't have a name for before, vocabulary words will stick around. I think we often see this with brand names, for example. You know, if you have a brand name and then it gets picked up a lot, it'll be around for a long time. Kleenex, Xerox, those are examples of words that have longevity. But generally speaking, vocabulary is very ephemeral and fleeting. And if I come up with a really cool new word today, unless it describes something really useful long term, it's not going to stick around. You know, so most of the words that we joke about today that we hear on radio or on social media, again, are in that category of quick, fleeting. And in fact, that's what makes them fun, is that we jump onto the bandwagon and have a great time with them for a few weeks, and then boom, they're gone. Along with the dodo and all those other things like bell bottoms. Oh, wait, those are coming back. So maybe that's not a good example, but you know, all those things that went away. But I think the ones that really stick around are ones that we have a use for, that are sort of highly helpful to our speech and to sort of the social identities we want to project. So when those qualities associated with that feature, and that could be a vocabulary word, but more likely it's something that's bigger than that. So when we talk about like, a lot of people think of it as just an individual word, but like as a discourse marker is part of a larger class of words that do a certain kind of work. So yeah. Like is not just one word you stick in. It's actually a sort of thing that has a metalinguistic purpose. And it does something useful to us. What does like do that's useful? Well, it projects a subjective sensibility. It provides speaker evaluation. Really, this sort of tracks with a larger change in our narrative culture over the last 50 years, where when we talk about things, we don't just tell facts, we tell stories, we tell our own view of things. And we often really like to provide our thoughts as they were occurring during the event we're describing. That's really new. We didn't do that 50 years ago. And so we didn't have the language for it. Like rose up to provide a hint to our listener that we're telling them something that's imprecise, it's inexact, but gets to the drift, or it's sort of a subjective view of something. So when I say something like, he was like, I don't think I'm going to go. And I was like, yeah, you should. No one listening thinks verbatim that's what he said. They understand that by using like, I'm just capturing the gist of what I intended. So when something is very useful like that and fulfills a void in our language that didn't exist before, like, then its potential to go for the long haul is actually quite, quite good. And I know this is going to make a lot of people cry, but like is probably here for the long term. It's one of the most rapidly advancing changes in our speech. It's massively useful, and it is sort of gaining ground so that every generation uses more like than the generation before them. Will we notice it and it bother us in 50 years? I don't think so. But will it still be around? I would put my money on it. In fact, if there's anybody that wants to start a pool to pay out in 50 years, I'm around. At least my kids will be here. Let's do it. So that's a good example of something that has a use. It fills a void, and it's beyond just an individual vocabulary word. It serves a function. And so those types of changes tend to have longevity.
Yeah. And significantly, I think in that analysis and understanding of the function of like, it's not a mistake, right? It's not like I just said it's not like. It's not a shortcoming or like a shortcoming on the speaker's behalf, but, you know, expressing something about that speaker's point of view.
Exactly, right? So it's really good for helping someone shift perspectives. So like is really a great perspective marker. That's kind of what it does. It's telling you whose perspective is being represented, and whether this is a verbatim thing or something that's just my view or my thought or my evaluation on a certain take of something. So yes, that's exactly why it's so useful and will probably stick around. And what's interesting is people don't like, and they think it's a Valley Girl thing, but actually thinking historically, we find like centuries ago in British English. So we find records of like used in the way it's used today as a discourse marker from the 1700s. So it's not a new thing at all. It's been useful for centuries.
Yeah, I mean, this is sort of my thing, where anyone who has any complaints about the language as it is today, or linguistic misusages, or, you know, bad English, as you call it in the book, just look at the written record. That's it. Just look at the written record, and you may be appalled or converted.
Yeah, you'll definitely think of your own speech differently, won't you?
So one of the last things that I want to revisit before I let you go is regarding children or the youth and young people being a force in linguistic change. We sort of alluded to this point when you were talking about how women pass on linguistic innovations to their kids and thus help sort of perpetuate them from generation to generation. But this, what I'm talking about, is a little bit different when I say that young people are a driver of linguistic change. I think that's categorically a little bit different than kids as recipients of the linguistic innovations of their mothers. Is that right?
Absolutely. If you want to look to who drives language forward, and I'm, by forward, I mean most evolving of language in terms of the new norms and new features that come into language and become the next thing that everybody does, you have to look to not just women, but young women and young speakers more generally. And I don't think that's a big surprise to anyone, especially if they have teenagers, because that's where you see all these novelties. And of course, we react to them badly. I have teenagers myself, and you know, I can hear them talking with their friends in the back seat. And as a linguist, I appreciate it. As a mother, I'm like, ew, you know, it's just the natural course of reacting to anything that's new and different. And, you know, a lot of the things that young people say will go the way of the dodo. We don't pick up on everything and bring it into language, but the things that are useful and serve a purpose end up sticking around, and they bring that with them into adulthood, and then they transmit that to their kids. And if you think about why young speakers are the leaders of linguistic change, it really makes sense when you think about how their brain is different and their social life is different from adulthood. You know, when you're in adolescence, your brain is still developing. You have a lot more neural pathways that can be laid down, and neural connectivity. We sort of have neural death as we get older. So we don't build new pathways and new neural networks the same way we do when we're adolescents or younger. We also are in an intense period of social identity formation. I think anybody who's ever gone to high school can remember very strongly the intense social anxiety that you had and the intense desire to be cool, whatever that meant for you, whether that meant you were a goth or a prep or a nerd or whatever group that was in. Part of the way you signal that is with your language. And, you know, there's some fascinating studies of language in high school, but what they all boil down to is you take this really vast neural plasticity and neural connection making, and you couple it with intense social identity formation. And then you throw in the fact that adults are really uncool at that age. You know, the last thing you want to be like is your parents. You put that in a blender, you blend it all up, and what does that give you? Language change. And that is what really the crux of why the young lead in linguistic changes.
Yeah, I love that. That's a sort of an extension of general teenage rebellion. Also affects language.
Absolutely, absolutely. And, you know, parents think they are really influential on their kids. I don't think that, because I have two teenagers and I know that I'm not. I have learned that the hard way. But what you realize is you're only influential on your kids' language really in the first 5 years. And then they do something called vernacular reorganization, which is where they go to school and they model their speech off of sort of the stylistic leaders at school, and they form their social identity. And that doesn't mean you have no influence on your kids' speech, but they really do take a lot from their peer group and sort of this intense social identity construction that they're doing. So I think what we can do as parents is get less worried about what's going on in their speech and just be more supportive of the fact that this is a time when they're really doing this searching of who they are, and language is just part of the way they find their path.
Okay, so the last thing that I will ask you, and sort of this goes into that predictive category. We can set up a pool here for anyone who wants to place their bets.
Okay, great.
sort of just getting into, like, what are some of the broad changes that are happening in English
And so more specifically, what I mean is, say, in 100 years, what are some characteristics that you think might make their way into what is quote unquote standard English, or at least or popular English, maybe we should call it that. Are there any features that you think will be in the, you know, widely spoken English that we may find surprising today?
One that gets talked about a lot is the disappearance of TH sounds, both voiced and unvoiced, the th and th sounds, because those are not very common in other languages, and, right, and pretty hard for English as second language speakers to pronounce. So there's ideas that the TH sounds will be pronounced with a S or Z or T or whatever it might be. So that's just one example that comes to my mind. I know there's, you know, lots of predictive discussions about vowel changes that will happen as English continues its globalization. But yeah, any you know, last thoughts about the English in 100 years from now?
Well, that, you know, that's a really great question. And of course, there's so many things that will, you know, change the course of how our language changes. But I think what we can all step back and say is that language change can be predicted in terms of sort of social forces that we anticipate are going to increase over time. And we know that that will have an impact. And I think one big one on language, on English, will be the vast number of speakers that speak English as a second language. You know, what we find is this really interesting pattern: as the number of speakers gets bigger of a language, as a language becomes a, you know, global language and has so many different varieties and so many different speakers, we find that that language actually, and I'm not going to use the word simplifies because that has a lot of values associated with it, but it tends to lose some of its more complex morphosyntactic structures over time and more difficult sounds over time that come into play with, for example, what you were talking about with TH. Now, we're not going to see it, I think, with something like TH. That's a complex sound that really most languages don't have, and that children are often late to acquire. Those are prime examples of places where the language will simplify over time. But it would probably be in context where it's intermedial of words. So it's in the middle of words, like brother or mother. It would be, you know, brava, mava, something like that. Or at the end of words, so it's something like teeth would be teef. Would probably be the way that would change. And actually, you can hear that in a lot of dialects today, because in word initial sounds like the or them, those TH sounds are more prominent, and we tend to lose things at the beginning of words less likely. So I don't think it'll be something like wholesale, all these sounds go away, but they just lessen in certain contexts. The other thing I think I'm going to predict, I'm laying my money on it right now, is that we will no longer have LY adverbials for the same reason. You know, that sort of morphosyntactic complexity, that's not necessary. It's redundant. When someone says, I walked slow to the car, that doesn't make anybody not understand what they're talking about. The LY is just simply an extra residual of actually an old English ending that had already been shortened. So it used to be slow like, and then lich ended up becoming like, and then it ended up becoming li. So, you know, we see this gradual atrophy over time, and now we see a very large variation between adverbs that have ly and adverbs that don't in those exact same situations. So real, good, instead of really good. And I think that's just going to continue. So my money is on ly going the way of the dodo as well. But in terms of other specific features, vowel changes are vast. You know, there are a lot of really fascinating vowel changes already happening in English. Back vowel fronting is something that seems to be pervasive across global Englishes. So I would predict that there will be no back vowels anymore in English. That we don't need them. Mid back vowels are basically the same thing, and we don't lose any meaning or intelligibility. And that tends to be the direction of change. When you don't lose intelligibility, but it makes simpler choices for all speakers trying to learn that language, that tends to be the direction of change over time. So I think these bigger forces are going to be what predicts the next frontier of English.
Yeah, I realize as I asked you that question, it's sort of kind of a very open-ended question to ask. Like, are you talking about semantically, syntactically, phonetically? No, that's great. That was a great answer. All right. Well, Valerie, tell listeners where they can find your new book, more about you, anything that you want to plug before we sign off today.
Sure. The book is Like Literally Dude, and you can find it anywhere books are sold. So, of course, Amazon or Barnes & Nobles, wherever you get your books, you can get it there. And you can also find out more about me and the book and the other things I do just on my website, which is valeriefriedland.com. I'm sure you're going to put that in the show notes. So my name's a little complex to spell, but you can find it there. And on that site, you can find out about the book, but you can also find out about my Psychology Today blog that I write every month for that magazine online. And then I also have links to my research. So if you're interested in learning more about vowels and how they change over time, which is something I research a lot, you can also look at that stuff there. So I'd love to have you sign up for my newsletter and just find me on my website.
All right. Fantastic. Well, we'll talk again soon.
Yes, it has been fun. Thank you for having me on.